Your book takes a data-driven approach to the question of which are more effective, violent or nonviolent resistance movements. Could you describe your approach as well as your findings?
Yeah, so we took a set of cases that are worldwide cases of both nonviolent and violent resistance from 1900 through 2006. We looked at cases where there were already over 1,000 people participating. So this isn't just any old campaign. These are already campaigns of nonviolent or violent resistance that are already, you know, achieved a certain level of maturity. And we only looked at cases where the campaigns were explicitly calling for the existing government to step down, where they were trying to expel a foreign military occupation, or where they were trying to secede. And once we did that comparison of 323 such cases, we found that the nonviolent campaigns were actually succeeding at those three goals about twice as often as violent insurgencies, and that this trend of the success of the nonviolent campaigns was actually increasing over time, so that in the last 40 years or so, nonviolent resistance was becoming even more effective, and violent rebellion appears to be becoming much more counterproductive.
Am I correct in understanding that at the center of your argument about the efficacy of nonviolent campaigns is the issue of participation?
Yeah, I think that's a fair way to categorize the argument. What we argue is that, you know, in the end, it's actually the participation rates that are really determining whether these campaigns succeed or fail. And that what we found is that the average nonviolent campaign, in just raw numbers, is something like four times larger than the average violent campaign. And if you account for the proportion of the population, the average nonviolent campaign is about 11 times larger as a proportion of the population than the average violent campaign. And what those numbers give to these campaigns is, first of all, if they're that large, then they probably are also pretty broad-based, which means that their participation is cutting across social cleavages, socioeconomic status, race in some cases, political party, gender, age, and the rural-urban divide. And once a campaign achieves that level of popular broad-based support, it's much more likely that it's going to initiate loyalty shifts within the regime itself.
I want to talk about a claim that you make in your book and in your TED Talk, which is that if a movement can garner the support of over 3.5% of the population, then historically there haven't been any examples of movements that have reached that threshold and haven't succeeded.
Yeah, and by active participation, we mean literally people prosecuting the conflict. So that's not quite the same as sympathy, for example, or people kind of quietly or covertly supporting the campaign. And my sense is that if 3.5% of the population is actively participating in the campaign, then there's probably an overwhelming number of people who are also highly sympathetic. So that's just a quick qualification on that.
I think what's so interesting about this sort of whole issue of civil resistance is the kind of larger point that it brings up about the nature of power. All you need is 3.5% of people to actively resist or to actively not participate in the existing power structures in a certain society, then the whole thing comes crumbling down. And I think that it kind of gives you some sense that power only functions so long as enough people abide by it.
You know, there's no such thing as an invulnerable, permanent authoritarian regime. Even those that have extremely tight control over all of their different pillars, their security forces, their intelligence services, their economic elites, those that rule by extreme fear, that no matter what the ruler is and how committed they are to staying in power and how ruthless, they are still 100% dependent on the obedience of those people that lie in those pillars of support. And the people that are in those pillars of support are complex human beings. They're not automatons. They're probably afraid as well, but they also have a variety of other interests in life. It's those people in those pillars of support that often are these kind of crucial lever on which the fate of these societies lie, and that in many societies, they're surprisingly vulnerable to being shifted by change or kind of a new compelling vision of the society and how it ought to be run. And they're also highly sensitive to the costs of maintaining their loyalty. And so, you know, power has to constantly be replenished. And in this formulation of it, it doesn't flow as much from the barrel of a gun as it does from the willingness of these people to continually obey again and again and again.
Right. What would you say are the implications of your work for foreign policy, questions of how, on a diplomatic or militaristic level, the American government, for instance, engages with either violent or nonviolent movements across the world?
Yeah, well, I think that the first thing that comes to mind is just that we don't really have a very well-established toolkit for dealing with nonviolent movements around the world. We have a very well-established toolkit for dealing with violent movements, but if you buy the data, then, you know, violent movements are becoming increasingly counterproductive as the horses to back in these races. And, you know, if anything, you know, the nonviolent campaigns are becoming, you know, much more successful. You know, the degree to which they can actually be influenced from the outside is extremely unknown and highly variable. And in fact, the United States kind of coming in and overtly supporting these campaigns might in some cases undermine them. It might in other cases legitimize them, depending on the context. But either way, this is an area of kind of new research that we don't really know a lot about that. And in the meantime, you know, in part because we don't know a lot about it, our toolkit is pretty limited. So, you know, it's sort of like when these things pick up, like in Syria, for example, in March of 2011, it's sort of like the United States doesn't know what to do until an armed group appears on the scene. And then the foreign policy elites start talking about the usual options, military intervention, arm the rebels. So I think what it's calling for is just a higher degree of creativity about, you know, how the United States can respond to these movements and, you know, maybe even support them before the armed groups arrive on the scene so that armed groups don't have to arrive on the scene.
Dr. Chenoweth, thank you so much for your time.
Of course. Thanks for the interview.